Man, is there an uproar in our society about homosexuality? There are people on both sides of the fence, people who really, from their heart, believe that it's right, and people who believe from their heart that it's wrong. I think what we need to do is go back to the scripture and understand, not based on what we want, but based on what's true, what God says, what is true about homosexuality.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Back in the Old Testament, there was a law that God put forth to the, especially the Jewish people, that said, is that right to the Jewish people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That you guys need to do a whole lot of stuff. There were a lot of different laws that they needed to obey, and they needed to adhere to it pretty religiously. Well, today, we don't adhere to those laws. The Jews don't, and we don't, except for some of them. There seems to be an inconsistency.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's particularly a problem today. I understand, I got an email the other day from a friend of mine who had heard of an email that Dr. Laura received. And in this email that Dr. Laura received, I actually got a copy of that, but I don't have it with me. In that email, they were rather facetiously taking Dr. Laura on for her now famous or infamous stand against homosexuality. I mean, Dr. Laura is a talk show TV personality now who's converted to Judaism and is making it part of her kind of agenda, her project to encourage people to, how does she put it? I don't know, obey God? I'm not sure how to best characterize the way she would characterize it, but that we as people are to take God seriously and take His commandments seriously and obey God. And so she has come out against homosexuality at some level. I don't even know exactly what her position is. But homosexual activists in our country have attacked her vigorously. And so when she was going to go on television for the first time, they mounted quite a campaign to try to get her sponsors to not sponsor her and to keep her from going on the air precisely because of whatever stand she's taken on homosexuality. So this email starts something about Leviticus calls homosexuality an abomination, and it sounds like it's being kind of favorable toward Dr. Laura, but then it goes on to make about 12 to ask 12 questions that are obviously facetious. Things like, I have a daughter and I want to sell her into slavery. The Old Testament law says such and such. Which should I do here? And the Old Testament law tells us that we're unclean if we have any contact with a woman when she's menstruating. But I don't really know how to tell. I've tried asking women, but that seems rather rude. What am I supposed to do about that? The Old Testament law tells us that we aren't supposed to wear clothing that has mixed kinds of fabrics. You know, you're not supposed to mix different kinds of fabrics in your clothing. And I can't remember what question they ask, but obviously the intent of every one of the questions was to, in a rather caustic and kind of facetious kind of way, to make the point, look, Dr. Laura, all of these laws are obviously outmoded, they're obviously antiquated, they're obviously irrelevant to us in modern society. No rational, moral person could possibly take these laws seriously, and yet the law that calls homosexuality an abomination is right there in with those. Can't you, are you so stupid that you can't realize that the prohibition against homosexuality is of the same order as all these other laws? They're antiquated, it's outmoded, it's a part of an ancient, meaningless religion that has no relevance to us today.
So we've thrown all these other things away. Let's throw away this ridiculous prohibition on homosexuality.
Exactly, right. While I'm there, this is sort of off the subject of your initial question, but as long as we're here, there was a piece in the local newspaper in here in Oregon. Oregon had a measure on the ballot in our last election that was wanting to make it a part of the Oregon Constitution that would prohibit educational institutions in Oregon from promoting homosexuality, that they didn't want the schools used to actually advocate, promote, and encourage homosexuality as a lifestyle. Well, that created quite a stir and quite a debate, as those sorts of measures always do in our society today. And there was a piece in the local newspaper that actually argued that only people who hate God would vote for a measure that said that we should prohibit schools from promoting homosexuality. And the rationale was because they had gone to the Old Testament and they had looked at the account of Sodom and had determined that the thing God had against Sodom is that they didn't feed the poor, that was the problem, and that homosexuality was not the issue. So God destroyed them because they weren't feeding the poor. So anybody who interprets the sin of Sodom as homosexuality is a morally stunted, immoral person and is against God, because God doesn't have any problem with homosexuality. He just has a problem with not feeding poor people. Well, all of that centers around how do we interpret what we see in the Old Testament in terms of the moral vision it gives us for how we as human beings ought to live. What role does the Old Testament play? What value does it have? Is it totally antiquated and outmoded and old-fashioned and irrelevant to us? Or is it not irrelevant to us? Should we take it in its entirety and intact? Virtually nobody does that. But if we don't, how do we justify not taking it in its entirety?
And so the question is then, if we don't take it in its entirety, then we're being inconsistent, and that's ridiculous. And if we do take it in its entirety, that's ridiculous also.
Right.
So I think their point must be, we've got to throw it all out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they never get quite far enough to tell us what they think we're supposed to do with this, other than implicitly, maybe you should just throw it all out. Yeah, exactly. So that's the issue.
That's the question on the table for us today.
Is what do we do with that? First of all, let me address the piece in the newspaper, even though it's not directly relevant to this question.
This is an important piece in question. The Oregon newspaper that said, you must hate God if you would vote to disallow homosexuality to be promoted in the schools.
Right.
You love God, in other words, if you would vote to allow homosexuality to be promoted in the schools. That's what this author was saying.
Yeah, I may be simplifying that and misrepresenting it to some extent, but yeah, that something roughly like that.
That's the question we're answering, whether or not that's exactly what the article said.
Right.
Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
I mean, the question I want to address is Sodom. You know, the argument for the position, whatever the position was, is that Sodom was not about homosexuality.
Ah, okay.
That's partially true, but that's a truth that that is telling a lie. I mean, she's telling a lie with that truth, because it's true that when you look at the prophets, they don't focus exclusively on the homosexuality of Sodom. That's true. That's very true. Some of the prophets point to their what they call inhospitality. The complaint against Sodom in the prophets is, if I were to put it in a word, is their shamelessness. That's the complaint that they had against Sodom. Every human being is evil, and lots of people have been as evil and has behaved as evilly as Sodom. But what brought down the judgment of God on Sodom to be a kind of object lesson was the shamelessness of their evil, I would argue.
The shamelessness. So I'm going to change your vocabulary here and say every person is a sinner, in that every person makes a lot of really bad choices, and those bad choices are considered by God to be evil. Against his holiness, they're evil. And that's what you mean by evil. Is that correct?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Right.
It's just a hard word for us to get our arms around, because we think of evil as being Hitler and not me.
Mm-hmm.
But evil is anything that doesn't come up to the standard of holiness,
right,
of God.
Right.
Okay. So you're saying that these people are sinning and they're shameless. That means that they don't care, that they're doing it without conscience, that they're running rampant with it, and it doesn't matter to them. They're not repentant. They have unrepentant hearts.
And I think we even have evidence that beyond that, they prided themselves in it. I mean, they almost delighted in their evil, delighted in their hatred of God, delighted in their flagrantly violating the will of God. And that's what made them such a prime target for an object lesson, is God is saying, look, I'm God, and ultimately I will not tolerate that. And just so that that becomes clear, let me take this pocket of shameless evil, this pocket of people who are shaking their fist up at me and defying me and telling me they're going to live their life any way they want to live their life, and they don't care about who I am and what I require of them, and let me show you what their destiny is. And he destroyed the whole city.
So it's kind of
the object lesson.
It's kind of a typical picture that we have of teenagers, though it's not fair to give it to teenagers. It's across the board to any human being. It's when my mom says, don't go out at night, just watch my smoke. Mm-hmm. I'll be out till 3 a.m. When my parents say that we want you to not drink and drive, just watch my smoke. I'm going to go to a party. I'm going to drink just as much as I want, and I'm going to go driving. I'm going to go drive, you know, up and down the state, and you just watch. And that's the kind of shamelessness that, you know, just watch. I'll just do it my way, that we're talking about in Sodom and Gomorrah.
Exactly. Right. And so there are lots of things that the prophets can point to. Their utter shameless lack of compassion for the poor. Their utter lack of hospitality to strangers, to aliens. I mean, it must have been a very violent, I mean, they talk about its violence sometimes, the prophets do. It was evidently a very violent city. I mean, most cities you could go into and people were self-respecting enough, they had enough shame, that they wouldn't dare be known as somebody who had violated a stranger. But this must have been the kind of city where you went into it and you were taking your life in your hands. You might just be killed by these people.
It was lawless. It was unconscionable.
Yeah, yeah, kind of wild, wild west.
There weren't any rules that people stood by. If I killed somebody, sometimes the way that we stay within the bounds of the law isn't because of the law, but because of how it might shame me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be known, for example, as a liar, because that's just a label I don't want to have. But in that society, it sounds like, be known as a liar? Okay, that's great. How can I be as bad as I can be? And so the restraint of how other people might perceive me or how I might feel about myself just wasn't there.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It was a group of people who were sociopaths.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I like the way you put it. Another way of describing them is they were unrestrained in their evil. no social restraints, no personal, individual restraints. I mean, nothing in them was any kind of, put any kind of boundaries on their behavior. Society did not put any boundaries. So it was an utterly lawless, chaotic society, I think. If you remember the account of Lot, and the two angels come to visit Lot, and Lot finds them in the, like, the town square, and they say, oh, well, you know, we'll just spend the night here, we'll just sleep here, and Lot says, oh, no, you won't. And you remember that scene? And he insists that they come and stay in his house for their own protection. Mm-hmm. And if I remember the text, the angels might even make a comment about that, about, that doesn't speak well for the city. I'm making all that up. There's certainly the sense in the text somehow that is a testimony. Maybe that's what they say. That's a testimony against the city. That you can't even, a stranger can't even expect hospitality by the city enough that they can be safe in the town square. What a terrible thing. But that's the problem. Now, where this article is making a huge, huge leap of logic and making a huge mistake and is being really short-sighted is not recognizing that homosexuality in Sodom was a piece of that, was a part of that. One of the places, one of the ways in which they were unrestrained is in their sensuality. They had no boundaries, and therefore they had no sexual boundaries. They were rapists. They were basically people who felt, if I feel a passion, then I'm fully within my, I'm sure they would even call about rights.
I'll just go for it.
Whatever I want, I'll do. Exactly.
And so for this author to say that Sodom was about not being hospitable is really, really, really minimizing it.
Yeah.
It, across the board, that's one thing that was a problem, but across the board there was this unrestricted,
unbridled rebellion.
Rebellion that said, I can go and feed my passions any way that I want. It doesn't matter who it hurts. That's not relevant here. If I want it, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
And homosexuality is a piece of that.
Right. Now, the way Paul looks at homosexuality is that it's a particularly dramatic and explicit evidence of that kind of unbridled licentiousness. That is, if I am, let's take lack of compassion for the poor. Is lack of compassion for the poor perverse? Absolutely. It's a real twisted part of humanity that we could be so self-centered and have so little regard for another human being that we could just leave them in their poverty without lending a hand to alleviate their suffering at all. That's a perversion, and perversion is not too strong a word for it. That's how the Bible would look at it. Yes, lack of compassion for the poor is perverse. On the other hand,
it's perverse in the sense that it shows up our heart. That's only looking at me. That's being very selfish. That doesn't match up to, again, the holiness of God. That's what makes anything a perversion.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it evil. Okay, so I think you're using those two words synonymously.
Right, I am, yes.
We are perverse and we are evil in that we don't meet up to the standard of God. Lots of times, Jack, the word perversion is used in relationship to sexual mores, that we are perverse because we do something or don't do something sexually. I guess do something sexually that we consider to be perverse. You're using it much more broadly in saying there's a lot that we do that's perverse, and it certainly isn't only limited to our sexual behavior.
Right. Yeah, the word really just means turned in the sense of twisted, in the sense of distorted. It's a distortion, a twisting of God's intention for humanity. So anything that is a twisting or a distortion or a turning around of my humanity to turn it into something that God did not intend it to be, or any part of my humanity into something that God did not intend it to be, is strictly a perversion, is literally a perversion.
So anything that is unreal rather than real, anything mm-hmm. that's wrong rather than right.
Right, exactly.
Anything that's bad rather than good.
Yes. So God made us to be compassionate. When our selfishness eclipses that and so obliterates my my compassion for other people, that it does not become a factor in how I treat other people, then that's a perversion. My humanity is not what it was intended by God to be, and therefore it is perverse. But the lack of compassion is a harder call to make, or a harder thing to see. It's not quite as obviously twisted. Selfishness comes so naturally to me. Everybody's selfish. You know, who's not selfish? And so it's easy to kind of pass off selfishness as just kind of part of what it means to be a human being.
Yeah, why bother even thinking about this?
Mm-hmm.
I had someone say that to me yesterday. Well, everybody struggles with wanting to have a claim from other people, so why should I bother even questioning that is a problem for me? Everybody wants other people to give them that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my answer was, yeah, it's true that we all want it, and that's the bigness of the problem. We really then need to look at it.
Right. Yeah, but because it is so everywhere, so ubiquitous, so universal among human beings, it's easy for us to take what's actually perverse and normalize it in our own perspective on it and think, well, you know, that's just normal.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason that the Bible kind of highlights homosexuality when it does and sees it as such a graphic representation of our perversion is because it ought to be harder for us to normalize that. And what I mean by that is, from the Bible's perspective, if we just look at nature, look at how God designed sexuality, all that is entailed in sexuality, all that it is purposed to involve and to include, it seems obvious to the biblical authors, as it does to us, and I think as it should to natural reason, it should seem obvious to us that God's intention was for heterosexual relationship. That's what he designed us for. That's what he purposed. So the fact that we would rebel against that and try to turn our sexuality into something that God did not design it for, namely homosexuality, what they're arguing is, if we don't see the fact of our perversion in that, then where are we going to see it?
I mean, your point is, that one's so obvious, and if we miss it, we're not going to be able to see our own perversion.
Right, right. And so that's why, like in Romans 1, when it kind of holds homosexuality out for us as the symbol of our rebellion against God, is it because homosexuality is somehow more heinous than lack of compassion for the poor? Not at all. It's not any more heinous. In some respects, it may be less heinous than lack of compassion for the poor. But they're both abhorrent. They're both outgrowths of a heart that has turned against God, who he is, what he wants from us, and have shaken our fist in his face and said, I don't want to be what you want me to be. I want to go out and make my life what I want to make my life, and you're not going to tell me what to do, God. All of those are manifestations of that same spirit and that same haughtiness, that same haughty rebellion that wants to be unbridled and unfettered by God and his rules and his character and so on. So homosexuality is neither more nor less abhorrent, neither more nor less an abomination to God than all these other things that were happening in Sodom, for example. But it wasn't any less abhorrent to God than those other things, and that's the mistake that newspaper piece was making. I mean, she was actually arguing it's not wrong at all, it's not immoral at all, because that wasn't the problem. Well, it was very much a part of the problem. And it seems to me inescapable, if you read the scriptures with open eyes, that it was intended to be part of what they saw as the problem in Sodom. But it's only part of it. That's true.
Okay, but someone could say, all right, so what? That's in the Old Testament. And so why are we picking that one out again? And not that you shouldn't wear clothes that have combined fabric.
Okay, exactly. Well, in order to sort that out, we have to come back to what is it that God was doing when he made a covenant with Israel in the Old Testament. What was he doing? What was that covenant about? Why was he making any covenant with them at all?
people might not have any clue what you mean by God made a covenant with Israel.
Okay.
What is a covenant, and what are you talking about?
Okay. Well, the story in the Old Testament is that God comes to this ancient Chaldean named Abraham, and he makes a promise to him, and he says, I'm going to take your descendants, that is a whole culture that identifies with you as their ancestor, as their father. I'm going to take those people and I'm going to form them into a people, and I'm going to be their God and they're going to be my people. I'm going to have a unique relationship with them. 400 years pass, nothing happens. Nothing all that remarkable happens. God deals with individuals, but nothing on a grand scale happens. The people of Israel, those descendants that God had made a promise with respect to them, are 400 years later, are slaves, are a slave class, are an underclass in Egypt. The working class, the blue-collar workers, the servant class, the slaves in Egypt. And God, through a series of events, takes this one man named Moses, who happens to be from among those people, but gets raised by Pharaoh's daughter in the actual court of Pharaoh, and takes him out into the wilderness. He has to escape for his life, run out into the wilderness. God appears to him and basically fundamentally says, Moses, remember a promise I made to Abraham 400 years ago? I'm going to keep it now. We're going to get started. I'm not going to keep it. We're going to get started on keeping that promise now. I'm going to send you into Egypt, and I'm going to have you demand of Pharaoh that he let my people go, and we are going to travel in mass up to the land of Canaan that I promised your father Abraham, and we're going to get going on this idea that I will be their God and they will be my people. So there's a fairly well-known story of Moses going into Egypt. Pharaoh won't let the people go. There's 10 plagues that God sends on Egypt, and finally, after the last plague, Pharaoh relents, sends the people out, and they all travel in mass following Moses as leader out of Egypt. Pharaoh changes mind, chases him with his army. The ocean parts so that the people of Israel can travel across the ocean, and just as the army is coming up behind them, and the ocean closes in again, collapses and drowns all of Pharaoh and all of his soldiers. They're out of Egypt. They've been delivered from bondage in Egypt, and now they're out there in the wilderness. They go directly to this mountain, Mount Sinai, where God told Moses to lead the people, and at Mount Sinai, God pulls out all the stops. He makes himself manifest, visible in history, to a degree that is unprecedented in all of human history. The mountain glows, the mountain shakes, God's voice comes out of the midst of the mountain and speaks to the whole nation. I mean, there has to be no question in anybody's mind in Israel that this is one awesome dude who has a lot of power, who is claiming to them, I will be your God, and I want you to be my people. And what happens at Mount Sinai is God makes a covenant with Israel. That is a contract, a sort of contract with Israel. And he's making a contract, and he's saying, here's what I'm going to do for you. And in exchange, here's what I want you to do for me. And he sets out a bunch of rules and regulations, what he calls statutes and ordinances and judgments that I am giving you today. I want you to order your society this way. Here's how I want you to operate. I want you to behave this way. I want you to treat people who don't behave this way this way. I want you to practice this religion. I want you to do this. I want you to do that and this other thing. And if you guys will do all of that and keep your side of the bargain, then I'll keep my side of the bargain. And my side of the bargain is to protect you from your enemies, to give you the rain you need, that your crops will grow, your cattle will prosper, you will prosper, you will be fruitful in the land, and I will give you an abundance in the land and keep you protected from your enemies. That's the deal. So that's what Bible scholars call the Mosaic Covenant, this contract that he made with them.
Jack, you know what I decided you are?
What?
You are a history book.
Well, I just read a lot.
Okay, go ahead.
So it's the content of that contract that is at issue, because it's in that contract that he made with them, those statutes and ordinances and judgments and so on, that we have the statement that homosexuality is an abomination, and don't mix two kinds of fabrics in your clothing, and don't eat this food because that you'll be considered unclean, and don't touch a dead body if you run across it in the field because you will be unclean, and don't cut the corners of your beard, and take some scripture and wear it around your head and around your belt. I don't remember how it gets phrased, but that kind of thing.
Tons and tons of minutiae.
Just all kinds of minutiae, exactly. And so it's easy for people to look at that and say, well, you know, either take the whole thing or reject the whole thing. But, you know, don't give me this picking and choosing parts of it that you want to use. Well, no, there's a good reason. There's a rationale why we can pick and choose from that contract what is directly and personally relevant to us today. And the rationale is this. God is doing a number of things in that contract, and he's putting them all together there in the same contract. Part of what he's doing is saying to Israel, what I'm asking of you is to be a distinctive people, or the King James, I think, translates as a peculiar people. I want you to be a really odd society, an odd people. And part of what I want you to do, therefore, is I want you to dress funny and look funny. I want you to dress funny and look funny because I want people to be able to spot you 10 blocks away and know exactly what you stand for. That, oh, you're one of them. You're one of those people who belongs to a society that is committed to holiness. And I want you to wear that on your sleeve.
I want you to stand out.
Yeah. So the idea of not cutting the corners of your beard, wearing these phylacteries, these funny little things where you have scripture tied in them, wearing pure fabric that is not mixed fabric. You know, I want all of that stuff to make you stand out as peculiar and odd and distinctive so that people can spot you a mile away. Does it have any more purpose than that? Oh, some of it probably has some symbolic importance, like certainly the wearing the scripture on your forehead and on your belt has to do with to symbolize the commitment of your mind and your heart to obedience to this covenant, to obedience to this contract. I'm sure that's what that has to symbolize. The not wearing mixed fabric, is that probably symbolic of purity of heart? Just as my clothes are unadulterated, so is my heart unadulterated. There's no mixture of good and evil, no mixture of holiness and unholiness, that you have made a commitment to purity of heart. I'm sure that that's what that symbolizes. I don't know what not cutting the corner of the beard might symbolize, but maybe in their context, in their culture, there would have been something that would have symbolized to them. So probably all of this had symbolic value, but even then the symbolic value was peculiarly and oddly relevant to that people and only that people, because they were the people who uniquely, of all the peoples of the earth, had been called by God to enter into this experiment in holiness with him. As an American, God has not called my nation to that experiment. The Chinese have not been called as a society to that experiment. The Irish have never been called to that experiment, to that unique experiment in relating to God. The Jews, and only the Jews throughout all of human history, are the only people that God has asked to enter into that kind of relationship and that kind of experiment with him. Well, that contract is about defining the terms of that experiment. That contract is not relevant to me in all of its features, in all of its entirety, unless I'm a Jew in that society that is taking on that experiment and has decided to go for it. Then and only then are the terms of that contract in their entirety relevant. But some of the terms, other terms of the contract were, I want you to practice a particular religion that I'm asking you to practice. So they had to be a religious people who kept the requirements of a particular religion. That's relevant only to them. God is calling them to that religion, not all of mankind, just them. Some of the requirements had to do with the structure of the society itself. How are we going to settle disputes? How are we going to punish people who have opted out of this contract? What are we going to do with people who have decided, I'm tired of this experiment, I don't want to be a part of it? What are you going to do with them? Because we're calling the whole nation to this experiment, not just individuals who want to be a part of it. It's either the whole nation or nothing. So how are we going to deal with people who are opting out of it? So there's regulations about how to do that. But then at the core of this contract is something, and I would argue, yeah, at the heart or at the core of this contract is another set of regulations, another set of terms of the contract that basically amount to this. I am the living God. I am a God who is good. I am a God who is holy. I am a God who is pure. I am a God who is light and is not darkness. If you're going to be my people, then your character, the commitments of your heart, are going to have to reflect my character. Nothing less than that will do in this society. I am a God of justice, therefore you must be committed to justice. I am a God of love, therefore your hearts must be committed to love. I am a God of mercy, your hearts must be committed to mercy and compassion. I am holy, therefore you must be committed to holiness in the entirety of your life. So, there's all kinds of regulations that enforce that, that ensure one of the laws in this contract is you must love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, that's a heavy commandment. I mean, that term alone will do us in, because that challenges me to the core of my being. Am I the kind of person who is so committed to love that I will be committed to love my neighbor as myself? That's what he's requiring of the nation of Israel. Therefore, many of the terms of the contract are moral in nature. That is to say, they have to do with being what a human being is supposed to be because he's a creature created by God in his image. And God, from the very beginning, has had an expectation that the human creature should live like this and should look like this. Well, all of those are universally relevant to all of mankind everywhere, but since they're universally relevant to all of mankind anywhere, God has also incorporated them into this unique and one-of-a-kind contract that he's making with this one-of-a-kind people, Israel. Well, to the extent that I recognize that a certain term of the contract that he's making in Israel is not about the oddness of Israel, but is about the holiness of God, that term of the contract becomes immediately and directly relevant to me. So when he says, love your neighbor as yourself, I can't dismiss that because, well, we don't have to worry about touching dead bodies any longer, so I also don't have to love my neighbor as myself. That's absurd. That's absolutely absurd. Because any moral, rational person ought to be able to recognize that moral vision, loving your neighbor as yourself, comes from God. To love my neighbor as myself is exactly what morality is all about, for all man, everywhere, in every time, in every place, in every culture. So the question then becomes, then the prohibition against homosexuality, is homosexuality called an abomination because it's kind of like touching a dead body in the field, that it's just part of those odd things that God is requiring of Israel as an odd people? Or is homosexuality an abomination in the same way that failing to love my neighbor would be an abomination? Is that it fails to take into account the character of God himself? It fails to make a commitment to reflect that character in my interactions with other people, particularly in the way I relate to sexuality. As we get to the New Testament, it becomes quite clear that the apostles and Jesus and the whole New Testament vision of sexuality looks back on that and sees, no, to say that homosexuality is an abomination is on the order of love your neighbor as yourself, not on the order of make sure you don't trip over dead bodies in a field. It's because it has to do with my character. It has to do with whether or not I'm willing to submit to the nature of sexuality as God created it. It's not symbolic. It's intrinsically and essentially moral that I be faithful to sexuality as God created it, which is as heterosexual.
So it looks to me like in the Old Testament, there was a whole group of laws that was made specifically for a group of people, and there was a ton of those laws, really a gillion of them that helped people kind of organize what their life was going to look like, and there was a lot of externals to it. You look this way so that people can see this or that. You do these things, you do these activities, you do this stuff. But there's a whole different activity going on in the New Testament where Jesus basically said, we're not kind of standing by the minutia of this law. That's not what's important. What we're doing is we're pulling out something that's basic in it. And that's that we want people to be given over to loving God from the depth of their heart.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows itself in some ways. It shows itself in, I guess it's embodied in the Ten Commandments in part.
Mm-hmm.
Honor your mother and your father.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really huge commandment that we have to kind of learn to be wise in order to really adhere to. I guess I can love my mother and my father a whole lot better as a 50-year-old than I could as a 5-year-old. And it's something that God grows us up in wisdom in order to help us to obey it. But it's coming out of a changed heart. Well, that makes a lot of the commandments from the Old Testament kind of irrelevant because they don't come from a changed heart. They're only stuff that we're doing. Homosexuality and our prohibition, the prohibition against it, is saying, we want you to love each other, and a changed heart would want you to love people in a manner that's consistent with God's creation.
Exactly. Exactly, yeah. I mean, just take, like, in the Ten Commandments, the prohibition against adultery. That's sexual in nature. Why is it that God has any concern about adultery? Because he has so created sexuality that the unfaithfulness of adultery is a cruel and treacherous violation of the person I'm committed to. It's a treacherous disloyalty. Is that like God? Is God treacherously disloyal? Does that reflect his loving character, his good character, his compassion, his kindness? No, it doesn't. It's a perversion of that. God is not like that. And so the requirement to not be adulterers is there because we shouldn't be like that either. We should be faithful to our promises. We should be faithful to our, we should be loyal to keep our word when we have made a commitment that is a meaningful commitment to another person in this way. So that's why adultery is wrong. Bearing false witness, I mean slander against other people, is a cruel, awful, treacherous violation of another person. To play fast and loose with the truth to the harm of another person is about as evil as you can get. Is that like God? No, God is not like that. God will always deal faithfully, truthfully with us, straightforwardly with us. He will never behind the back slander us to our harm. So when we get to homosexuality, am I doing right by the sexual being that God made me to be, by the sexuality that God has given me, if I turn sexuality into what homosexuality is, rather than have my sexuality play the role in my life that God intended it to have, to be that language used in a heterosexual relationship of marriage, whereby we celebrate and renew and ratify our commitment to one another for life. That's what God created sexuality to be. Homosexuality is not about that. And since it's not about that, it's a violation of what God intended. Therefore, it's a kind of vandalism. It's a kind of standing before God and saying, I know that you made sexuality to be this and to play this role in my life, but frankly, God, I have a better idea. And I don't really care what you want sexuality to be. I want it to be what I want it to be, and I'm going to go out and I'm going to make it what I want to make it. And I really, frankly, God, don't care what you think about that. That's in effect what we are doing. Is that moral? Is that to be rightly related to God and truth and the world and myself and others? No, it's not. And so it's really a moral issue. It's not just symbolic. It's not just, I want you to be an odd people. I want you to be a people where you don't tolerate homosexuality, because that would be odd. That's not what he's saying. It's really all about goodness itself, as that translates into our sexuality. You commented earlier that, you know, what is the law ultimately all about? You said it's about loving God. Both Jesus and Paul say that explicitly. I mean, in answer to the question, how do you sum up the law, which I think is to say, how do we get right down to the essence and the core and the heart of the law? And they say, it's to love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and your neighbor as yourself. You get those two things right, and you're doing right by the covenant. And Paul says effectively the same thing, in effect the same thing, explicitly. So, yeah, that's how they are looking at the law.
And what becomes confusing in our culture today is that, well, yeah, I am loving someone by having a homosexual relationship with them, and in fact I'm loving myself. And that's because truth has become relative to my standard rather than a standard that's based on the goodness of God.
Mm-hmm. And we have to remember how foolish we can get. I mean, we maybe not in quite the same widespread scale, but we also hear the message, I'm loving this little child that God has created by murdering it and by destroying it. We hear that as well. And we also hear that I'm loving this person by lying to them, by hiding the truth from them. Any evil we ultimately justify by saying it's in their best interest. But that's our foolishness, that we take something that is actually evil and find a way to call it good in our own mind. But we shouldn't be deceived by that. That's our sin speaking to us.
And that's because we kind of make ourselves God. We don't recognize that we're who we are and that God is who He is. We think that our standard really does measure up. And we're foolish. I think that's the ultimate of our foolishness, is we have made ourselves the standard and don't get that we don't get it. Yeah. We don't get that we're small. We don't get that we're the created. We don't get that there's a God that gets it a whole lot better than we do. I think we just get what we want.
Yeah.
I want to be the standard. I want to define things the way I want. And so I'll decide that it's the best. And that's what's really gotten us in trouble.
Yeah.
And that's where we need to go back to, is that I'm not the criteria for what's good, but God is. And even though I might not get it, even if I'm a person who's burning with passions, woman toward woman or man toward man, it isn't about what I feel. It isn't about what I want. It isn't about my own personal comfort. It's about what is good. And we have lost sight of that, and we need to find it again.
Absolutely.
In her News and Views article, Reconciled Enemies, Mackenzie Study Center staff member Nancy Scott examines the common Christian belief that spiritual maturity depends on pursuing a personal relationship or friendship with God. She argues that the test of one's relationship with God is not whether one feels in fellowship with God. Rather, it is how one answers the question, what are we going to do with the fact that God is in charge of our lives and we are not? She states, the choices we make about how we respond to the circumstances of our lives, and not whether we pursue friendship with God, will ultimately attest to God's working in our lives. Call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Reconciled Enemies.
It has been really exciting, a really good thing for Jack and I to get together and dialogue about so many different issues with the backdrop of the Bible, trying to understand the Bible better, trying to understand how it fits into our lives in a real, practical way. In addition to the radio, we've been trying to think about what are some other ways that we can dialogue with our listening audience and with other people to perhaps even expand the audience that wants to listen to what's being taught here at Christianity at Work. So we came up with the idea of offering seminars or workshops to people out there in your community. We would like to offer this for a weekend retreat, for a women's group, for your support group, for a men's group, a women's group, a home group, for your church, for schools, for colleges, just about any group that wants to get together and put together a workshop. We'd be really excited to help you out. The format that we're thinking about is an interactive one. Just as you hear on Christianity at Work, Jack and I are interacting with each other. The topic could be one of your choice. It is really wide open for us. What you want to have us present, we'd be very happy to do that. We also appreciate the dialogue between ourselves and our listening audience. We've had a couple of times where we've gone out to different communities, and that has just been a wonderful thing to get to know you, to see you, to interact with you personally, face to face. So your questions would be a big part of what we would do in any seminar. Depending on the response, we may not be able to meet everybody's needs, but we're going to try and do the best that we can. If you're interested in this, we invite you to contact McKinsey Study Center. It's at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And the telephone number is 541-485-4801. And those addresses will be, and a phone number will be repeated at the end of the program. We hope to hear from you.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKinsey Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKinsey Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKinsey Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKinsey staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKinsey staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKinsey Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKinsey, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKinsey Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKinsey Study Center, thank you for listening.